It is my great honor to present one of my heroes, Frank McCourt, to you this evening.
I never thought I'd wind up in Harvard. I didn't even go to high school. I missed that because in arts, economic circumstances, there was no such possibility in my generation anyway. So we went to what they call a national school in Ireland, which is the lowest on the level and the hierarchy of educational institutions. So when you went into national school in those days, it was understood you'd be up by the time you were 13 or 14, and then you'd go and get a job as a messenger boy or something like that, until you could get a little older. Then you go off to England to work in the building trades or something like that. And at that time, it was a very miserable business being Irish and going off to England, because half of us suffer from the Irish national disease, tuberculosis. And the other disease, of course, was alcoholism. And then we also suffer from Irish history, and we suffer from Catholicism. Boy, were we a suffering nation. My Jewish friends of mine talk to me about Jewish suffering, Jewish guilt. They haven't a clue. Because we have hell, and they don't. When I discovered the absence of hell in Judaism, I was delighted, because I was able to throw it back at them. But don't give me your Jewish, give me your Jewish suffering. We have hell. Not only do we suffer on this earth, but one misstep and the next thing, you're in hell in the next life. And that was very, like my generation, I was very conscious of sin. And this is the main, these were the main elements in our education in Ireland. And I'm talking about it because I went from an Irish educational system, if you want to call it a system, to American. From an Irish elementary school or primary school, and then my next experience was teaching in a high school in New York. But the elements of Irish education, in our economic level anyway, there was another school in the city called the Christian Brothers, where the brothers taught, and where they were pretty brutal. This is one word that rings out through the history of Irish education: brutality. There was another school run by the Jesuits, that's for the upper classes. You know the Jesuits, the super theologians. They're the ones with their brains. And they were the ones who got invited to dinner by the upper classes in London. So, Christian Brothers were not invited. And so, the teachers in our school were not invited. They were lay teachers. I didn't have nuns, and I didn't have brothers. Friends of mine here and everywhere had the nuns. And they could be pretty tough too. But what they taught us is what I recount with great curiosity. The main thing was that Ireland had been invaded 1,000 years ago, 700 or 800 years ago, by the British or the English, i.e. the Normans. The Normans brought French and they brought English, whatever the language was got flowing on, and a lot of Latin. They brought all of this, and it was all through a woman who betrayed us. Again. Another woman. So we were invaded by the English or the Normans, and a lot of them became more Irish than the Irish themselves. You might hear the name Fitzgerald or Fitzsimmons. So Fitz means, a lot of people are proud of having the name Fitzgerald or Fitzsimmons or Fitzpatrick. Fitz means bastard son of. They don't know. On the coat of arms, they have this bar, sinister, that goes the wrong way. So, the main thing we learned, we had the victim-type education, which you have to be careful about when you come from these circumstances. We were invaded. They took our language away from us, although we resisted. Then they tried to take our religion away from us. I mean, I have to give my forebears credit for holding on to Catholicism, despite the temptations and the brutality of the English. I don't want to go into an anti-English tirade now. We could be here till midnight. So they almost killed the Irish language, which they're trying to revive now. So in addition to this invasion by the English and the sufferings of my forebears led to a great tsunami of poetry and lamentation. and immigration, songs about immigration coming to America and all of this. And we sang these songs. We all knew the song. Every kid in Ireland knew the same song. When there was a party in any one of our houses, the parties were usually given when somebody died. The Irish wake, if you knew that. And the Irish wake was conducted so that the dead person was always in the next room in the bed. And we would sing and tell stories and so on. And it would become so enjoyable that the person in the bed, the dead person in the bed, if they could really resist joining the party, then we knew they were dead. That's what it was called, the wake. So we had our poetry, we had our lamentations, and we were taught to hate the English, but we were in a peculiar position because we were speaking the English language and we were exposed to some of the English poets, Tennyson and people like that. And then there was Shakespeare. How could you hate the English if they produced people like this? So we were very confused. That was our only confusion. The other confusion was the one Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. And we were caught early because at that time, I remember one day my mother getting ready to go someplace. She was taking particular pains with her appearance and her hair. She actually washed her hair, which was a rare thing in the Limerick of our time. And she went around the corner to St. Joseph's Church. And I was 10, and I followed her. I went to see what she was up to. And she went up the middle aisle, and a priest came up with an altar boy. And she stood there a while, and the priest mumbled some Latin, blessed her, and threw some holy water on her. And I couldn't figure out what it was. It wasn't any sacrament that I was familiar with. So I heard that I was always snooping around listening to adults. That was my favorite activity, listening to adults, because I thought they had secrets. And I wanted to grow up and be privy to these secrets. So I was listening to my mother talking to her friend Bridie Hannon next door. And what had transpired was she got around the corner to St. Joseph's to be churched. Very few of you here will know what that means. To be churched. She had just had my brother Alfie, the younger friend, and she had to be purified. That was churching. I think they've done away with it now, but she must have been one of the last women in Christendom to be churched, purified. I think in Judaism they have similar rituals, but I thought this was done away with a long time ago. But they got us early. They got us before we were born, and talking about the church. And when we were born not clean and pure, but we were born with original sin, and that had to be washed away. And it came from what was happening in the Garden of Eden a long time ago. Adam and Eve did the bad thing, and they cast this sin onto us. So we had something called original sin. And when they were teaching us this in school, the concept of original sin, I had a very strong sense of imagery. And I always, for instance, saw the soul in the chest somewhere. And it's in there, and it's like great white frisbee. And when you sin, a blotch appears, a kind of an abscess appears on your chest. And then it becomes putrid. And all this goo and pus and blood begins to flow down your white frisbee of the soul. And that's a sin. And there were various sins. The size of the abscess dependent on the size of the sin. There are various sins. I'm telling you this because this is how we were educated, or conditioned, or brainwashed. There are various sins. In Limerick, we were told, first of all, in that hierarchy, there's something called the unforgivable sin. So what's the unforgivable sin? Nobody knows. But you'll know when you do it. Have to go to Rome for confession. So we never knew what it was. And I thought, I guess I haven't committed it because I haven't felt it yet. And then below that is another big one called the sacrilege. That would be like, I don't know, kicking a nun in her thigh. Or desecrating an altar, something serious like that, so we can go to the church. And then, or punching a priest maybe, which my father threatened to do one time. But then the next sin below that is the mortal sin, which is the common one. You know, the seven deadly sins. When I was teaching at Stuyvesant High School, we were talking about James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and 80% of my class was Jewish. And it suddenly occurred to me they didn't know what I was talking about, what James Joyce was talking about. And I said, "You know the seven deadly sins?" Blank stare. I said, "Well, how the hell can you enjoy yourself?" So I had to tell them, cry, covetousness, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. So they had to teach them. You know, I felt very awkward teaching Jewish kids the seven deadly sins. And then, of course, we got into the Ten Commandments and so on. The mortal sin is the one we all commit all the time. This pride and lust and greed and so on, and anger. And then below that is the venial sin. That's the little white lie. Oh, I had a flat tire, the train was late, or something like that. Each of these sins has an appropriate punishment. There are a number of places you can go when you die to expiate your sin. First of all, there's heaven. If you lead a good life, you go to heaven. And the reward, and I asked the teacher, I got into trouble, I was always getting into trouble with my question. The reward for leading a good and virtuous life is that you stand before the throne of God for eternity, to gazing on his divine countenance in awe, wonder, and reverence. And I mentioned the suggestion that that was very boring, standing up in a God's face for eternity. I didn't see any value in that. It sounded a little more attractive. And the strange thing is, when the writers write about heaven, even Dante, when they write about heaven, it doesn't thrill me one bit. The writers on hell are much more gloomy. The priests were really inspired when they talk about the walls of a million miles thick, that sermon in the Portrait of the Earth, walls a million miles thick, and the temperature is a million degrees Fahrenheit, and this is for eternity and eternity and eternity. There's no release ever from hell. Our little minds, 6-year-old, 7-year-old minds, were trying to encapsulate this, trying to understand eternity and this awful punishment from this God who is all loving and merciful. We couldn't reconcile all of this. So that was the punishment of the community, I suppose, the unforgivable, or the sacrilege, or the mortal sin. Then for the venial sin, there was another punishment, the little white lie. If you died with this venial sin on your frisbee soul, it wasn't that bad, you know, the little white lie. So you were sent to purgatory for maybe 4 million years. Expiate this little white lie, or the train was late and so on. And eventually you're released, and you go up to heaven. I suppose you're on parole in heaven. And then the other one that I could never understand was limbo. Limbo is where unbaptized babies go. A lot of you here are not Catholics, and this is where you're going. If you have a child that was not baptized into the one Holy Roman Catholic and the Apostolic Church, that kid is surely not the limbo. But now in the Vatican, this year, they're discussing abolishing limbo. where would the babies go? All of this used to confuse us. There are Hindu babies go, there are Muslim babies, Buddhist babies, they all got to limbo. And I thought limbo wasn't that bad, because I imagined it as a place, kind of a dark place, with no great suffering. All these little babies were equipped with sets of wings, and they would fly around and chirp away for eternity. But now I suppose if the Vatican comes to its senses, the babies will be released, and I don't know if there will be room in heaven. We had to try to figure out all of this stuff when we were in school. We had to try to figure out the Trinity, and we did. They told us about the virgin birth. Well, we didn't understand what they were talking about at all. We didn't know what a virgin was, and we weren't exposed to what they call the facts of life. But all of this was laid down as dogma. You had to believe it, and that's all there is to it. And as a matter, when I, before the Vatican Council in the 1960s, we were told you couldn't eat meat on a Friday. That's why fish became so popular on Fridays. If you receive a communion on a Sunday morning, you couldn't have anything after midnight the night before. And we said, sir, what happened if you swallowed a spit? As long as you didn't do it deliberately. So we used to sit in the schoolyard talking about all of this stuff, heaven and hell and limbo and purgatory, all our various destinations, all of us trying to figure out where we were going to go. So one kid said, we're not going any place, we're going to America. Evelyn Waugh said one time that for the Irishman, there are only two destinations, hell or the United States. So this is the stuff we were trying to figure out. We didn't get much help from the schoolmasters. We called them masters, not teachers. Masters. If you asked a question, if you raise your hand, you're in danger of losing it. So you had to be very careful about questioning anything, because the teachers would literally go into a rage if you question Irish history or Catholicism. So this was our conditioning. In addition to that, everything was memorization. We had to memorize all those songs and hymns. The last class every day was 1 hour of singing, which I thought was a good idea, because we'd sing in Irish, English, and Latin. We had to learn all the Latin hymns. And the master, whose name was Tom Scarron, would walk up. He had us standing in rows, about four rows, and he'd walk up and he'd stick his ear up against your mouth to see how your singing was. And if you went flat, he'd drag you out and knock you around the room and make you stand there and sing again until you got the notes right. That's how we learned to love music. You walk up and down, so we're chanting away in English, Irish, and Latin. I think that was very valuable because, as I said earlier, we all knew the same songs. When I was teaching at Stuyvesant High School and various other high schools, the kids did not know, had no repertoire of songs. One time I took a group of seniors from Stuyvesant High School to some kind of a fair playground out in New Jersey, and I tried to get a sing song going, and they all knew one song. We all live in the other side. That's all they knew. They knew no American folk songs, no jazz, nothing like that. They didn't even know the popular ballads of Frank Sinatra, people like that. So, but we all knew these songs. And this we had a tradition, I suppose. We had a very tight tradition of Catholicism and, of course, the 800 years of suffering under the English. And we were told we were a great fighting race. We fought, we rose up all the time in rebellion, and we fought. But at the last minute, we were always betrayed by some son of a bitch of an informer. The filthiest word in Irish or English was Cromwell. If you said anything good about Cromwell, you'd get knocked around. Not that anybody ever said, but he was the great villain of our history. This is all the stuff that we had to absorb. And what fascinates me about it, what makes me think about it a lot, is what it did to us. That they tried to drive all curiosity out of us. We couldn't ask anything about it. We couldn't say, well, why is it we didn't win any battles in 800 years? We won one or two. So, but then the ultimate climactic battle came in 1916, the Easter Rising of 1916, when the great Irish men and women took over the post office in Dublin, and held out for a week or so, and the English bombarded it, and they were driven out of the post office, and they were taken off, and 16 of the leaders were shot, which was the turning point for the British Empire. That was the end of the British Empire, because a few years after that, the Irish got their freedom, and when the Irish got their freedom, everybody wanted their freedom. Indians, Pakistanis, everybody all around the world, they started demanding their freedom, and it was the fault of the Irish. Because they started the end of the British Empire. So we were told all of this. Along with that, then the other element of an autobiography in my case was the economic circumstances. We grew up in a drinking culture. And on a Friday night, when the men, whether they were on welfare, the unemployment, the dole, or whether they had job, everybody went to the pubs. Friday night was the big night for the pubs. And they'd sit there and they'd drink the pint, the noble pint, which leads to philosophy. That's why Ireland has hardly produced a philosopher, because all of the talk has been done with the pint. So what's the use of going home and writing a book when you've delivered yourself of universal opinions? And they didn't. And nowadays in Ireland, if you go to Ireland now, it's cocktails, it's binge drinking, cosmopolitans, Long Island tea, and if you don't mind, martinis. Well, Sean, as far from martinis, you were brought up. And this is the way they're talking to each other. But the binge drink is epidemic now, and on Saturday nights they're killing each other by the dozen on the roads of Ireland. So stay at home on a Saturday night if you go to Ireland. That's the new Ireland, which I'll get to in a minute. But this was our conditioning. The circumstances, our economic circumstances, were, it was expected eventually that my father and a lot of the men in his class, working class, would go off to England. My father went off and forgot that we existed, leaving my mother with four boys. I was the oldest, I was 10 or 11. And we were left to beg from the St. Vincent de Paul Society, whatever charity. My mother had to go around to various priest residents and ask, like a lot of women, looking for leftovers. So this doesn't do much for your self-esteem when you know your mother is out there begging. These are the circumstances. And I think it had a very, very negative psychological effect on us. We were not encouraged to think. Our curiosity was not nurtured. There was, even if we did sing at the end of every day, it was a grim business because of the lamentations of the immigrant songs and the Latin hymns and the Irish lamentations. So there wasn't much joy. The only relief we had was when we left school and ran in the streets of Limerick and then made our own stories. When I was teaching in various schools in New York, I listened to the kids coming in the morning talking about what they watched the night before on television. And I recall that we talked about what we did the night before. We were out in the streets, we made up our games, we didn't want to go home. Our mothers would come out at twilight and call us. And you hear these women all over Limerick, "Sean, Michael, come home. This is the last time I'm going to call you. Paddy, Mary, come in, or I'll break your bloody countenance." All you hear this, it was like a symphony of calls. And we were so excited with life, with being on the streets. We didn't want to go home, and the darkness would come down, the street lights would go up. And then we'd go home, we'd sit and we'd have our tea and bread. That was our diet, tea and bread, a solid and a liquid. Davin's diet. We'd have this tea and bread, and then we'd talk. Once in a while, my mother would get enough money to go to a movie. I remember she got to a movie. I don't know why I remember this stuff so vividly. She goes to a movie when I was 9, I think, called Reap the Wild Wind. Ray Milland, John Wayne, and Pauline Goddard. And she came home and she recounted every frame of that movie. And we sat there in rapture because she built it up. She was in the center, a masterly storyteller. And that's all we needed. Of course, we wanted to go to the movies ourselves, but we didn't have the money. But if anybody went to a movie, if anybody went anywhere, they were expected to come home and describe it. What did you do? I remember one time going up to the north of Ireland, seeing my father's family. I was 20. I was in the United States Army in Germany. And she said to me, we sat down by the fire, and I'd been in America by this time. She said, "Well, Francis, what is it like to be on an airplane?" And I said, "What kind of a silly question is that?" She said, "What is it like?" And I realized that she'd never done it, and she wanted to know, what is it like to be on an airplane? And that's the task of the writer, to describe what it's like to be on an airplane. And I was challenged by this. This is my first challenge, I think, as a narrator or a storyteller or whatever you want to call it. But when I heard the kids in New York talking about what they watched last night, my heart sank, and I said, "Is this, what are they going to talk about?" Are they going to tell their children and grandchildren what they watched on television? What are their adventures? What adventures were there? Well, you know, they used to say to me when I would assign something to write something autobiographical, yeah, well, Mr. McCourt, it's all right for you. You're lucky you had a miserable childhood. You have something to write about. And all we have is comfort and refrigerators and sheets and beds and what about going to go to college? We have nothing to write about. And why is that? Well, run away. So whatever, they can take any chance like that. So eventually, I was finished with school when I was 13. My father had gone off to England, forgot about it. We survived somehow at 13 then. It was time for me to get a job. You know, at 13, it's the beginning of adolescence. It was a very troubled time for me. You begin to ask questions, and then there's the simple fact that the hormones begin to rage, and a 13-year-old boy, a 14-year-old, finds his body irresistible, and that's a sin. The sin of impurity, called self-abuse. I never felt abused, but there you go. Ecstatic. And then you have to go to confession. So as I said, you're born with the original sin. That has to be washed away with baptism. Then, 6 or 7 years later, you have to go for your first confession. And they tell you the sins, all of these mortal sins, venial sins, and the punishments and rewards thereof. More emphasis on punishment than on reward. And you have to think of all the things you did. You're 6 years old and you go to your first confession. And you make them up. I don't know what, I hit my brother. A big deal. I couldn't find anywhere in the Ten Commandments of the Seven Deadly Sins any admonition against hitting your brother. But I told the priest. And he sits there like a lot of priests, bored to death. And then you hear a woman on the other side telling the priest that, you're whispering that, Father, I refuse to do my wifely duty. Which means the husband came home of a Friday night, said, all of it, into the bed, Mary. And she refused because she had a headache or something like that. And she refused to have sex that night. And that's a sin. That's a sin in Ireland. It's a peculiar Irish sin. You won't hear about it in Boston. You can look at it in certain Irish parts of Boston. If the wives are refusing to do their wifely duty. So that's a sin. It had to be confessed. And I used to have my ear cocked to this little window, and I'd hear the women confessing their sins. I never wanted to leave. As a matter of fact, I thought at one time I could be a priest. I have a great time listening to all these secrets. So the adolescence approaches, and I'm feeling it's hopeless. I'm sinning right and left. As the boys would say, oh, you're at yourself again. And you go to the priest. And I found, I think I was 14 or 15. I found a priest, an old redemptorist priest, who was about 95, deaf. And I go out and confess my sins to him. He'd hear my sins, and then he'd give me absolution. And I'm a patriot, and he'd give me penance. We said three our fathers and three home. And we had this beautiful relationship for a year. And then I went in, and the little penance slid back, and it wasn't my man at all. It was another priest. A young man with this big ear, like a turnip. And I knew I was in trouble, that he was going to hear what I said. And I said, well, Father, I did dirty things. That means anything to do with the flesh. And he said, my child, was it with yourself, or with another, or with some classic beast? This man was opening new horizons. Whenever I rode my bicycle out into the Limerick countryside after that, I looked at every sheep and remember my extended family. So there was this constant sense of sin all the time, no matter what you did. you couldn't look at a magazine where they were showing lingerie or anything like that. And that, I love that word lingerie, but it's a sin. It was a sin to look at in any magazine. So this went on, and then I was sinning so much I stopped going to Mass and communion and confession. I knew that I was doomed. I went around with this heavy. It's very hard to explain it to those of you who are infidels. You go around with this heavy sense of sin all the time. I wish I'd been a Buddhist or something like that. So then I come to America and I land and I'm telling myself I'm going to go to confession someday. I'm going to go to confession. But I couldn't summon up the courage. Then one day I was working down in a warehouse near the docks, and I was loading some pallets with cartons of Del Monte sliced pineapple. And one of the cartons fell down and hit me on the head, and I got a concussion. And I was taken to a hospital called the French Hospital, which was run by nuns. And the next thing, I have a priest at my bedside ready to hear my confession. And I couldn't tell him about the years of sin and so on and my utter depravity. And I lied right and left. And then he gave me absolution. Off you went. Then I knew I compounded my sin, because it's a sacrilege to lie to a priest. It's always hopeless. It was a terrible time in my life. But I was rescued by the Chinese. They attacked Korea. And America got nervous and turned to me and drafted me into the United States Army. I sent me to Germany for 2 years, to Bavaria, when I got to Bavaria, they said, I was infantry, 16 weeks and 4 days infantry training. Then they said, you're going into the canine corps. I said, what's that? Dogs. You're going to be training dogs. I said, I don't like dogs. 2 years in Limerick, I was attacked by dogs right and left when I was delivering telegrams. My heels were chewed off. You're going to train a dog. So they gave me a choice of Doberman Pinschers or German Shepherds. Naturally, I chose the German Shepherd. But if a Doberman Pinscher gets you, he doesn't let go. You have to kill him. So I spent 18 months training dogs and training dog trainers. And I got, which was very good preparation for my future career as a teacher. Then I was discharged. I was discharged from the army, and I hardly knew what to do with myself, because even though I knew of the existence of this most wonderful piece of legislation called the GI Bill, how could I practically? All I could do with the GI Bill was say, I'm going to go to high school and get my high school diploma. But I didn't want to be a high school student. So I was working in the docks, and one day we finished unloading the ship, and the pier boss told us to leave. It was 2 o'clock and we finished, go home. So I was walking up Hudson Street in New York, and I went into this bar called the White Horse, where Dylan Thomas, the poet, drank himself to death, which is a good reason for going to the White Horse. I had no intention of doing that myself. So I ordered a beer and a sauerkraut, because after my 2 years in Germany, I was a very Teutonic gourmet. and I sat there, and I did something very dangerous for a young Irishman. Without the equipment, I started thinking and asking myself the meaning of it all. And I had no answers for that. And I felt this sense of despair. What the hell am I doing? Am I going to be working on the docks for the rest of my life? Because I saw men much older than I was, 40 years and 50 year old men, and looking very tired and alcoholic and the rest of it. And I just walked out of the line, out of the White Horse, leaving a half a beer and a half a knockwash, and walked across Bleecker Street in Greenwich Village, and found myself, something was leading me. I don't know what it was, something spiritual that day, some force led me over to New York University, and I asked somebody almost in an automatic state, where is the admissions office? And they said, in there. And I went in and filled out the form for admissions. And they thought it was very amusing that I was filling out that form without ever having gone to high school. They said, where did you go? And I left the line blank, high school, year of graduation. I said, I never did. And this is serendipity or something. The dean of admissions was passing by at that moment. She said, what's going on here? Her name was Florence Beeman. They said, well, he wants to come to New York University. He never went to high school. And she said, well, where did you go to school? I said, Ireland. And then I got desperate. It wasn't not. I was not pushy or aggressive. I was very timid and very shy. And I said, yeah, I've read a lot of books. Oh, she said, what have you read? I said, I've read Dickens. What, she said, everybody reads Dickens. Oh, they had to ratchet it up a bit. Well, I read Dostoevsky. Oh, what have you read? I said, The Brothers Karamazov, Crime and Punishment. Oh, but what she did, it hadn't clinched it. So I said, I thought I'd take the big leap. And I've read James Joyce's Ulysses. Oh, well, you know, nobody reads James Joyce. That's one of the reasons it was never banned in Ireland. So, she was impressed by that, and I was admitted on a year's probation, provided I maintained a D average. Well, after my experiences in Limerick with the schoolmasters in Limerick's National School, I think I did handle the B average very well, even though I was working about the school days, nights, and all of that. So in 4 years I graduated and got my teaching license. The teaching exam consists of a written exam, multiple choice, which I detest, composition and grammar, and then an interview with this board of English department chairman. And then a teaching test, we had to teach a demonstration lesson. If I got through all of that, the passing mark had to be 65. I barely got through with 69. And then I had to look around for a teaching job. I went to a number of schools in the suburbs. I had a dream about teaching maybe in Long Island or Westchester, Scarsdale, one of those rich suburbs. And I'd go in there, because all I knew about American teenagers were the movies. I used to see these movies of Mickey Rooney and all these bright, jolly kids, of boys, all fair-haired, broad-shouldered, blue-eyed, and they were all named Chuck. They were quarterbacks. And all the girls were blonde and blue-eyed, and they had bosoms that were apocalyptic. And I'd be teaching in this school, and I might be going on about Chaucer, and they'd be writing all this down in the notebook, and one of them would go home and say, Mom, we have this wonderful new Irish teacher, and he's really cute, and the mother is a widow. To my age, or younger, and she said, honey, why don't you bring him home? And I brought him home for dinner, and we fall madly in love with each other. And she says, why don't you give up teaching, stay at home and write a bestseller? And that would be my dream. But that never happened. As a matter of fact, the suburbs didn't want me. Because as soon as I opened my mouth, I said, well, you know, you seem to be very bright, but, you know, there's this problem with your foreignism, your accent, you know, your brogue. Oh, I said, well, I'm not foreign. And they said, well, I'm Irish. And then they said, well, I'm sorry, but we don't want our children to sound like Barry Fitzgerald or Maureen O'Hara. So I was told along the way by friends of mine, teachers and other people, if you're going to teach, do not go near a vocational high school. Well, that's the only job I could get. McKee Vocational High School in Staten Island. And I was launched into teaching. The principal took me to the room, gave me the course to study. Here you are. So there I was. And this was my first day. Those of you who have ever taught high school will understand what it was like to face those kids. Here's what happened to me in my first day. A kid named Andy, or Petey rather, called out from the back of the room, anyone want a bologna sandwich? You kidding? Your mama's hate you giving you sandwiches like that. Petey threw his brown paper sandwich bag at the critic Andy, and the class cheered, fight, fight, fight. The bag landed on the floor between the blackboard and Andy's front row desk. I came from behind my desk and made the first sound of my teaching career. 4 years of higher education at New York University, and all I could think of was, hey! They ignored me. They were busy promoting the fight that would kill time and divert me from any lesson I might be planning. I moved toward Petey and made my first teacher statement. Stop throwing sandwiches. That's called classroom management. Petey in the class looks startled. This teacher just stopped a good fight. New teachers are supposed to mind their own business or sent to the principal or a dean, and everyone knows it's years before they come, which means you can have a good fight by waiting. Besides, what are you going to do with a teacher who tells you stop throwing sandwiches when you already threw the sandwich? From the back of the room, Benny called out, "Hey, teach! You already threw the sandwich. There's no use telling you not, don't throw the sandwich. There's the sandwich right there on the floor." The class laughed. There's nothing sillier in the world than a teacher telling you don't do it after you already did it. Professors of education at New York University never lecture on how to handle frying sandwiches. They talked about theories and philosophies of education, about moral and ethical imperatives, about the necessity of dealing with the whole child, the gestalt, if you don't mind, the child's felt needs, but never, never about critical moments in the classroom. Should I say, "Hey, Petey, get up here and pick up that sandwich or else," or should I pick it up myself and throw it in the waste paper basket to show my contempt for people who waste food? They had to recognize that I was boss. The sandwich, in wax paper, lay halfway out of the bag. The aroma told me there was more to this than bologna. I picked it up and slid it from its wrapping. It was not any ordinary sandwich, where meat is slapped between slices of tasteless white American bread. This bread was dark and thick, baked by an Italian mother in Brooklyn. Bread firm enough to hold slices of rich bologna, layered with slices of tomato, onions, and peppers, drizzled with olive oil, and charged with a tongue-dazzling relish. I ate the sandwich. It was as if somebody wrote a script. Who's passing by at that moment looking in the window? The principal. I'm summoned to his office and I'm reprimanded for standing there at 9 o'clock in the morning eating. As I tried to explain to my grandmother what it's like to be on an airplane, I tried to explain what happened. You know, it's very hard sometimes to explain simple things. Kid throws sandwich, misses the other kid, sandwich lands on the floor, and I ate it. How difficult it is to explain things to resistant people. Then he warned me, that was my first day. Then the next day, something happened. This was a turning point in my life. The second day of teaching, I think, was a major turning point in my career as a teacher, as a man, an individual, and so on. This kid, Joey Santos, calls out, "Yo, teach!" "You're not to call out. You're to raise your hand." "Yeah, yeah, yeah, yeah," said Joey. They have a way of saying "yeah, yeah" that tells you they're barely tolerating you. In the "yeah, yeah," they're saying, "Look, man, we're trying to be patient, giving you a break because you're just a new teacher." Joey raises his hand. "Yo, teacher, man, call me Mr. McCourt." "Yeah, yeah, yeah." "So, like, you know, you Scotch or something?" Joey is the mouth. There's one in every class, along with the complainer, the clown, the goody-goody, the beauty queen, the volunteer for everything, the jock, the intellectual, the mama's boy, the mystic, the sissy, the lover, the critic, the jerk, the religious fanatic who sees sin everywhere, the brooding one who sits in the back staring at the desk, the happy one, the saint who finds good in all creatures. It's the job of the mouth to ask questions, anything to keep the teacher from the boring lesson. "No, I'm not Scotch, I'm Irish." "Oh yeah, what's Irish?" "Irish is whatever comes out of Ireland. Like St. Patrick, right?" "Well, no, not exactly." So this leads to the telling of the story of St. Patrick, which keeps us away from the boring English lesson, which leads to other questions. "Hey, mister, Everyone talk English over there in Ireland? What kind of sports you play? You're Catholics in Ireland?" Don't let them take over the classroom. Stand up to them. Show them who's in charge. Be firm or be dead. Tell them, All right, open your notebooks. Time for the spelling list. Teacher, God, spelling. Do we have to do more boring spelling list? They pretend to bang their foreheads on the desk, bury their faces in their folded arms. They beg for the pass. Gotta go, man. We thought you was a nice guy, younger. Why all these English teachers have to do same old thing, same old spelling lessons, same old vocabulary lessons, same old shit, excuse the language. Can't you tell us more about Ireland? Your teacher, man. It's Joy again. Joy, I told you my name is Mr. McCord. Mr. McCord. Yeah. So, Mr. Like, did you go out with girls in Ireland? Oh, damn it, sheep. We went out with sheep. So the class explodes. They elbow one another, pretend to fall out of the desk. They go home that afternoon, and Mom is there. She says, how was school? You know, we've got this new teacher. He's got this thing about sheep. And then the principal gets 19 telephone calls. And I call back to his office and goes, what's this about sheep? And once again, there's a difficulty of explaining something that seems to be very simple. And he's warning me. And I said, I'm sorry. They kept asking me questions. I was exasperated. That's it. I thought the sheep thing was a bit funny at the time. Oh, yeah, he said, yeah. You standing up there advocating bestiality. There are righteous people in Staten Island. Well, I was only joking. No, young man, no jokes here. There's time and place. When you say something in class, they take you seriously. You're the new teacher. You say you went up with sheep, and they're going to swallow every word. So then he gives me my first little hint of administrative punishment, that if you do anything like this again, I'm going to have to put a negative letter in your fire. And I suppose I didn't respond appropriately. Negative letter, he said, in your fire. That means this could impede your upward progress. I said, what upward progress? you might want to be an assistant principal. I said, I came here to teach. Yeah, he said, they all say that. 6 months from now, you'll be clamoring to get out of the classroom. You'll be taking courses in administrative supervision. And I said, well, no, I didn't. Then I realized something about the system. Then I realized something else began to, the various levels of understanding I began to develop, that there's a peculiar thing in the school world that if you leave the classroom and you go up the hallway and you become an assistant principal or a guidance counselor or principal, the rewards are greater. If you stay in the classroom, you stay with the same old teacher salary, but if you become an administrator and you're far away from the kids, you get more money and benefits, and you get a secretary, a private toilet with double-plate toilet paper and so on, and you go up to conferences around the world where you discuss recalcitrant creatures under the waving palm trees of Maui and places like that. Meanwhile, the teachers are back in the classroom slaving away in the ditches of pedagogy, and you say, why the hell should I stay here? So you're encouraged. Many teachers just can't. The seduction, the inducements to leave the classroom are so great that it takes a lot of willpower to stay where you are and engage in that strange profession called teaching. So this was the first hint to me of this other world. So, but I stayed on. I spent my 8.5 years in McKee High School, and I suppose I lasted because the kids gave me a break. It was this business of, you know, you Scotch or something, Irish, and then they started asking me questions about my life. I mean, we dealt with the sheep part of it. But then they asked me questions about what it was like growing up. And you know, they were about 50% sincerely interested in my background, because teachers were generally warned, don't tell them anything about yourself. So I tell them a few stories about growing up in Ireland, and there's one story I used to tell them about. It's in Angela's Ashes, about how I earned my fare to America by stealing from a dead woman. A dead moneylender. It's all right if it's a moneylender. Dead woman is something that, she's a dead woman moneylender. So you can steal from dead moneylenders. I stole, I think, £50, and that enabled me to come to New York. But I think if I wasn't very gifted or talented in many ways, what I was able to do was seize things that enabled me to survive in the classroom. Certain things would happen, I'd say, this works. And then I would do it again. You know, there was a kind of a doggedness in, I suppose, in my if you want to call them methods, I had no methods. I went in shock from the hip because people told me, the teachers would tell me, that in the high school classroom, you're a drill sergeant, a rabbi, a shoulder to cry on, a disciplinarian, a singer, a low-level scholar, a clerk, a referee, a clown, a counselor, a dress code enforcer, a conductor, an apologist, a philosopher, a collaborator, a tap dancer, a politician, a therapist, a fool, a traffic cop, a priest, a mother, father, brother, sister, uncle, aunt, a bookkeeper, a critic, a psychologist. You're everything in the classroom. You think you're just going to go in there and teach English, because how do you handle certain situations?
Mr. McCourt, can I see you during lunchtime?
Okay, Ruth, what is it?
Well, it's Danny. He wants to go out with someone else.
Here's my lunch hour. How old are you?
I'm 15.
What? 15. And you didn't want to be. You didn't want to be cynical or hard. But Ruth, you're 15. You like to.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
But you know, in a few years, Ruth, I can say this from experience. You'll forget him. You'll go up to college and a year after this, you'll say, his image will begin to fade in your head, and then in a year, two more years, you'll say, Danny who, you'll forget his name.
Not forever!
And then you get these essays, because there's a lot of racial tension between the Puerto Ricans and the Chinese. Neither one was supposed to go out with the other. That was forbidden on both sides. So I get a composition written by a Chinese girl, Rose, and she said, me and Jose are going out, and our families don't approve, and we're miserable, and we're fed up with them, and someday we're gonna get on the A train, and go out. We're gonna go out to Rockaway Beach, and we're gonna walk the beach hand in hand, and as the sun goes down, we're going to walk into the Atlantic till the water closes all our heads. Gurgle, gurgle, gurgle. The sun will be going down in the Atlantic. I said, well, that's a pretty neat trick, Rose.
What?
The sun going down in the Atlantic. Mr. McCourt, you're not a bit romantic. So this goes on, and the stuff that goes on in the hallways, the classrooms, and then, of course, I won't even go into what you have to put up with in the administration and supervision department, because the teacher's under constant scrutiny. You have these teenagers watching you all day, looking, and they can tell instinctively the state of your health. Sometimes in the beginning of my teaching career, I was very foolish, and I was adhering to my old ways, going to the Lion's Head Bar down in Greenwich Village and hanging out with all these journalists and writers and so on, not getting home till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, flopping into the bed, getting up at 6 or 6:30 to get the train and the ferry to Staten Island and walk into the classroom.
Hey, yo, Mr. McCoy, you don't look so good, huh?
They'd make the drinking motions. So you can't do it. You can't do it. If you're teaching, you can't do anything else. It's as simple as that. You don't go home and write novels or any kind of professors do. They write thousands of books that only their colleagues can read. They have all their time. You rarely read of a high school teacher suddenly appearing in the pages of the New York Book Review or anything, or the New York Times. You rarely hear about high school or elementary school teachers. By the time you get home, you want to collapse. I did. I was tough. I worked in the docks. I was lean. I was muscular. I could work from 8 to 5 every day, unloading ships and trucks, and then go out eating foot-long bologna sandwiches and liverwurst, and then drink beer all night and go home, go to bed, 12 or 1 o'clock and want to get up and go up, get back in the docks again, teaching honor. You face the kids, and there they are, the raging horn moans. They're either hungry or horny. And you deal with all of that all the time. And it's tumultuous. They're in the class and their face, they're looking at you. And it's as I said to a group earlier, it's very dramatic. A 45-minute class is the most dramatic thing in the world. Most of us didn't realize it or don't realize it. It's a one-act play. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there you are. You're the director. You're the screenwriter. You're the producer. You're the actor. You're the stage manager. You're the makeup. You're everything in this 45 minutes. And all of this stuff is going on. And you develop all kinds of antennae. Your antenna are out, and you're sensing what's going on in the classroom. Are you reaching them? You know if you're not. The longer you're in it, in the beginning, it's awful in the beginning because you're making your way. And the main thing is that I discovered, the main thing about teaching and writing and anything, you have to find yourself. Who the hell is up there standing in front of the classroom? What is your style? I didn't know I was developing a style of teaching. But a lot of it depended on the tolerance, the kindness of my students giving me a break and not killing me. Because that's their function, is to kill you. Because it drives so many teachers out of the class. And the Latin teacher, Stives in high school, came in one day and just sat there in front of the class and broke into tears and he was taken away. On a disability, which he never came back. Because they had their ways of dealing with it. But I grabbed onto certain things. One day there was the kids were taking a test, and I was sitting there watching them taking the test. And I just pulled out one of the drawers where I used to throw excuse notes. They're required to bring in excuse notes if they're late or if they're absent. Mom, Dad, right, usually Mom, write excuse notes. And here's what happened. Mikey Dolan handed me a note from his mother explaining his absence the day before. Dear Mr. McCart, Mikey's grandmother, who is my mother, 80 years of age, fell down the stairs from too much coffee, and I kept Mikey at home to take care of her his baby sister so I could go to my job. Please excuse Mikey, and he'll do his best. P.S. His grandmother is okay. When Mikey handed me the note, so blatantly forged under my nose in the classroom, I said nothing. I'd seen him writing it at his desk with his left hand. Writing with his left hand to disguise his own handwriting, which because of his years in Catholic elementary schools was the best in the class. The nuns didn't care whether you went to heaven or hell or married a Protestant, as long as your handwriting was clear. And if you were weak in that department, they'd bend your thumbs back and you'd scream for mercy. Also, if you wrote with the left hand, it was clear proof you were born with a satanic streak. And it was the business of the nuns to bend your thumbs, even here in America. So there was Mikey laboring away with his left hand to disguise his exquisite Catholic handwriting. This was not his first time forging a note, but I said nothing because most of the parental excuse notes in my desk drawer were written by the boys and girls of McKee Vocational High School. And if I were to confront each forger, I'd be busy all day. An excuse note is just a part of school life. Everyone knows that fiction. So what's the big deal? Parents getting kids out of the house in the morning have little time for writing notes that they know will wind up in the garbage anyway in the school. They saw Harry, they said, oh, you need an excuse note for yesterday, honey. Write it yourself and I'll sign it. They sign it without even looking at it. And the sad part is they don't know what they're missing. If they could read these notes, they'd discover their kids are capable of the finest American prose. Fluent, imaginative, clear, dramatic, fantastic, focused, persuasive. I threw Mikey's note into a desk drawer along with dozens of other notes. Notes written on every size and color of paper, scrawled, scratched, stained. Isn't it remarkable, I thought, how they resist any kind of writing assignment in class or at home? They whine and say they're busy and it's hard putting 200 words together on any subject, but when they forge these excuse notes, they're brilliant. I have a drawer full of them. that could be turned into an anthology of great American lies. The drawer was filled with samples of American talent never mentioned in song, story, or scholarly study. How could I have ignored this treasure trove, these gems of fiction, fantasy, creativity, craw-thumping, self-pity, family problems, boilers exploding, ceilings collapsing, fire sweeping whole blocks, babies and pets pissing on homework, unexpected births, heart attacks, stroke, miscarriages, robberies. Here was American high school writing at its best. Raw, real, urgent, lucid, brief, lying. The stove caught fire and the wallpaper went up and the fire department kept us out of the house all night. Arnold doesn't have his work today because he was getting off the train yesterday. The door closed in his school bag and the train took it away. Ronnie's sister's dog ate his homework and I hope it chokes him. Susan's baby brother peed on a story when she was in the bathroom this morning. A man died in the bathtub upstairs and it overflowed and messed up all of her homework. Jane's big brother got mad and threw her essay out the window, flew all over Staten Island, which is not a good thing because people will read it and get the wrong impression unless they read the ending, which explains everything. Harry had the composition you taught him right, but he was going over it on the ferry, and a big wind came and blew it away. We were evicted from our apartment. The mean sheriff said if my son kept yelling for his notebook, he'd have us all arrested. I imagine the writers of these excuse notes on buses, trains, ferries, and coffee shops and park benches try to discover new and logical excuses, trying to write as they thought their parents would. So I typed up a dozen excuse notes on a stencil, distributed them to the class. So, yo, Mr. McCourt, what's this? Excuse note. Who do you mean? Who wrote them? You did. Or some of you did. I omitted the names to protect the guilty. They're supposed to be written by parents, but you and I know the real authors. Yes, Mikey? So what are we supposed to do with these excuse notes? Well, we read them aloud. I want you to realize this is the first class ever in the world to study the art of the excuse note. The first class ever to practice writing them. You're so lucky to have a teacher like me who has taken your best writing, the excuse note, and turned it into a subject worthy of study. They're smiling. They know. Now, you know, some of the notes on that sheet were written by people in this class. You know who you are. You used your imagination. You didn't settle for the old alarm clock story. You'd be making excuses the rest of your life, and you'd want them to be believable and original. You might even wind up in the future writing excuse notes for your own children when they're late or absent. Try it now. Imagine it's a few years from now, you have a 15-year-old son or daughter who needs an excuse for falling behind in English. Write it. They didn't look around. They didn't chew on their pens. They didn't dawdle. They were eager, desperate to make excuses for their 15-year-old son. It was an act of loyalty and love. And you never know, someday they might need these notes. They produce a rhapsody of excuses ranging from a family epidemic of diarrhea to a 16-wheeler truck crashing into a house to a severe case of food poisoning blamed on the McKee High School cafeteria. They said, could we do more? How do I handle this enthusiasm? I told them, you can start this here in class and continue at home or on the other side of the moon. What I'd like you to write now is an excuse note from Adam to Eve, from Adam to God, or from Eve to God, explaining what went down in the Garden of Eden. The heads went down, hands raced across paper. They could do this with their hands typing on the page, with their eyes closed, secret smiles around the room. Oh, this is a good one, baby. And we know what's coming, don't we? Adam blames Eve, Eve blames Adam, they blame God, blame all around. And who has the upper hand that kicks them out of heaven? God, so their descendants wind up in McKee Vocational High School, writing excuse notes for the first man and woman. And maybe God himself needs an excuse note for some of his big mistakes. The bell rang. And for the first time in my 3.5 years of teaching at McKee High School, I saw high school students so immersed in the writing, they had to be urged out of the room to go and have their friend, to go and have their lunch. Then on the next day, I was going to school to McKee on the ferry, in the Staten Island ferry, and I was reading the New York Times obituary section. And when I went into that first class that day, I said, I want you to write your obituary.
Yeah, what's an obituary?
I said, you're an account of your death. We're not going to. We're not going to do it. They're not going to write how we died. I said, well, just try it. Use your imagination. And they did. And it produced strange results. The girls, all died surrounded by their family. Inconsolable weeping mothers. And as they drifted off into oblivion, the last faces of mom and dad weeping away. The boys also died in the bed. But the last image they had as they faded into eternity was the face and bosom of Marilyn Monroe. Which, of course, was a sin. But then I thought I'd expand on the obituaries, and I had them write obituaries of each other, and some of them were very vicious. They write obituaries of the classes. But I think I hit pay dirt when I said, choose a teacher. Write an obituary of a teacher. Not a single teacher had a peaceful passing. They fell into snake pits, some were drained with water torture, they were flattened by bulldozers, they were stripped alive, skin used by him. And then, and they loved doing that. They came to life, the kids, because this is really something where they could use their imagination and maybe let it all out. And then I go up to the teacher's cafeteria, and our one teacher, as I sat down, he picked up his tray and moved away. You have the kids killing us off. Some of the teachers thought it was very amusing. So this is how I survived my 8.5 years in McKee Vocational High School. And then I departed from the curriculum. I didn't pay any attention to the course of study. I realized that the administration didn't care what you did, as long as you kept them in their seats, kept them quiet, kept them from having fights in the classroom. And if they did have fights in the classroom, veteran teachers would tell you, don't go near them. Stay back. Call for the principal or dean, and as you know, it's years before they come. And then they fight. They used to pull out the rungs, these metal rungs, on the chairs and go at each other, which was very dangerous. But so we have, this is the kind of the thing that the other kids would jump on them and separate them. This was all part of something they didn't tell us about at the New York University courses on pedagogy. They never told us about flying sandwiches or anything like that. They never told us about excuses. They never told us what to do when a kid accosts you in the hallway during lunchtime and wants to tell you her troubles, how her boyfriend is leaving her, and so on. No, there was none of that. You had to make your own way. And as I said earlier, you developed your own style. And I was lucky, I think, that Joey Santos asked me that day about growing up in Ireland. And he was, as I said, he was about 50% serious, and they want to keep you away from the lesson. It was invariably, if I said, okay, vocabulary, we're going to do homonyms, synonyms, and antonyms. So, like, Mr. McCourt, did you go swimming in Ireland? Did they have any water in Ireland, Mr. McCourt? So, were you a Catholic in Ireland? Were you a good Catholic, Mr. McCourt, and all this stuff to keep you away? And afterward, you know what they're up to. And then I was able to find other ways of surviving in the classroom. And I told them one day, they resisted poetry. They resisted poetry and grammar. And I had to find various ways of getting through, of overcoming the resistance, because it was a challenge. So I told them one day, I was going to recite to them my favorite poem. Oh, God. Poetry. I said, this is my favorite poem. Are you listening? My favorite poem. Little Bo Peep has lost her sheep. Doesn't know where to find them. Leave them alone, and they will come home, wagging their tails behind them. So, like, you know, Mr. McCourt, you're like, you know, you're really weird. This is your favorite poem? I say, yes. And I said, you want to discuss the deeper meaning? Our teachers always discuss the deeper meaning of poems. And I said, well, what happened? What do you think? What is it all about? Well, you know, it's just a little bald peach. It's not the sheep, doesn't know what to find. I said, well, what does she do? She goes home. She went home and waited for them. She didn't go up bothering them. She didn't call the police. And if you don't bother people, they'll come home, wagging their tails behind them. So Bo Peep was cool. She's a cool shepherd lady. And all the sheep came home, they all came into the living room, and she fed them whatever you feed, sheep, grass, or something like that. And they live happily ever after. You know, Mr. McCourt, you are weird. I said, would you like to know my second favorite poem? Well, you know, if you want it. Humpty Dumpty sat in the water. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses, all the king's men couldn't put Humpty together again. I said, what's that all about? Well, you know, like, you know, it's like, you know, it's like, you know, just like, you know. It's like, you know, the egg falls off the wall. Oh, really, I say in my grand sarcastic manner, because I'm a few steps ahead. Oh, really? The egg falls off the what? Yeah. I said, where in that poem does it say egg? Well, it's an egg. I said, where? If you were in court discussing this poem, where does it say egg? Well, you know, everybody knows it's an egg. I said, yes, everybody knew the earth was flat too at one time. Where does it say egg? Well, you know, everybody knows it's an egg. Everybody knows it's an egg. I said, how do you know it's an egg? Well, you know, so I read it somewhere. Where did you read it? I want you to bring in the book that says it's an egg. Well, you know, it's like, and then we'd work it out. We find out this somebody had seen an illustration in Lewis Carroll of Humpty Dumpty, the egg. Lewis Carroll, illustrator, created this egg. So that was his image of the egg. And then we had to get in with that. Then I had a wonderful book called The Annotated Mother Goose, which showed, you know, gets into the deeper meaning of Humpty Dumpty and other poems. And we discussed the possibility it might be a symbol of the church in England being fragmented into various sects, etc., etc. And they didn't like that at all. They walked out of the class mumbling. This is what happens when you go after the deeper meaning of a poem and you start ruining. They were okay with the Bo Peep because the deeper meaning eluded them. And it eluded me, and most poetry, the deeper meaning of most poems eluded me. That's why I generally stayed away from what you might, poetry that you could interpret. We recited poetry. We recited The Cremation of Sam McGee, Dangerous Dan McGrew, Gunga Din, all those narrative poems. And they were always waiting in every high school class, any college class, whenever there's an activity, the sword of Damocles is hanging over their head. When is going the test going to be? So, like, you know, well, what is the test? What test? You know, the test on, you know, Humpty Dumpty and all that shit. No, there won't be a... There's no test. You mean we're just sitting around here with certain there's no test. How are you going to give us our grades? And a few years into my teaching career, I said, I'm not. Yeah, but we have to have grades on our report card. Then now we get into the serious business of evaluation, high school evaluation. I said, no, this was in later on in Stuyvesant High School. I said, we have to have report card grades. I said, you do it yourself.
What?
Do it yourself. Evaluate yourself. 0 to 100. Give yourself a grade. And then write a little paragraph explaining how you arrived at this grade, 0 to 100. And that was astonishing. It was astonishing because they wrote their paragraphs and they did what we're used to doing in the Catholic Church. You infidels wouldn't understand it. Examination of conscience, which I was used to. That's why I didn't see much need for psychotherapy. But you can go to a priest and get a free penance and absolution. So I had them evaluate themselves from 0 to 100. And most of them evaluated themselves honestly. They write the paragraph and they go home and they think about what they had done, if they were absent, if they caught, if they didn't read the book and so on. And it was astonishing for me because I said that because of that honesty. And because also they were examining the whole business of evaluation and the whole business of honesty in school. And I think they felt they were thrilled to be trusted. And I felt that this was an astonishing breakthrough when I discovered that the grades they gave themselves approximated what I might have given them within five points. That was, for me, was a big discovery, and I began to use this more and more and more, to the great discomfiture of the head of the English department and the principal and the authorities in general. And I tried to get other teachers to do it, but they wouldn't do it. And then I had groups, five groups in each class. One group would evaluate another group and give me grades all around. And that turned out to be a very an authentic way of evaluating, because they had to talk about how do you judge an essay, how do you judge a short story. They had these discussions which were probably more valuable and enriching than anything I might have taught. And so these were the discoveries I made along the way. This is what helped me to survive, because I turned a lot of it over to them and encouraged them to speak out. And I think this was in response to the subjugation that we suffered in Ireland, where we were not allowed to utter an opinion, venture an opinion, or ask a question. Then I survived the 18 years of Stuyvesant High School, which is more challenging, I suppose, intellectually. At McKee, there was violence in the class. It was housekeeping. It would take half an hour to get them to sit in their seats. In Stuyvesant, they came in, they sat down. They're all come to Harvard and Yale and so on. And the competition for grades was cutthroat, so they would challenge me intellectually on any story or anything I was doing. So the years ended there. I came to the end of it, and they used to ask me questions about growing up in Ireland too. And then they would say, you should write a book, and I thought I would. I do what I'm told, and I went home. I went home that last day. After the last day of my teaching, the English department gave me a lunch. Teachers get the lunch. Principals get the dinner. Superintendents get the dinner with a French menu. So I went home that day after that lunch, and I was in the apartment by myself down in the village, Brenton 12th Street. And it was the first time in the 30 years that I reflected on the course of my career. And I was able to look back that afternoon and say, sit there with my white wine and say, I'm glad I did that. It was good, and I hope I was useful. That was my last thought about teaching. Thank you very much.